Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome. I just spoke with Matt Wisnowski about his new book, Engineers for Change, Competing Visions of Technology in 1960s America. MIT Press published that in 2012. This is a book that looks at discourses and debates about technology, its dangers, the benefits that it might provide for society, and the responsibility that went with both of those aspects of technological change in American life between the 1960s and the 1970s. At this moment, engineers were constituting themselves and constituting their profession, both individually and in large and small groups across America, as they wrestled with issues of responsibility, among other things. How did the individual engineer both envision himself or herself within a group? How did the individual engineer navigate the poles between, on the one hand, trying to maintain a professional, responsible professionalism, and on the other hand, figuring out ways to agitate for social justice in those cases in which the engineer might feel that there were larger social goals that their position situated themselves to help with? Okay. In the course of the book, Matt looks at a number of really interesting case studies that range from professional contexts like the institutions of MIT, Princeton, Harvard, Caltech, Harvey Mudd, to a popular press and an alternative press that emerges out of social activist groups made by and for engineers, to a number of other kinds of media and kinds of outlets within which engineers and people who are concerned with engineering as a discipline and as a practice, as a group, are really struggling to come to terms with and redefine some key concepts that are central to this period of really massive technological, social, cultural, and political change in American history. We see capsule histories here of notions like innovation, creativity, collaboration, process, responsibility. And these are just some of the major touchstones in this really fascinating history of not just engineering and engineers, but what it meant to be a responsible citizen and a professional in this context of massive transformation in 1960s, 1970s America. It's a fascinating book. It was really wonderful to talk with Matt about it. And there's a lot of really rich discussion and a lot of ways that he fleshes out his own process in the course of the interview. So I hope you'll listen and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Matt Wisnowski about his new book, Engineers for Change, Competing Visions of Technology in 1960s America. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Matt, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me today.
Well, and thank you, Carla. This is really an excellent service, and I'm happy to play my little part.
Oh, my pleasure. So, Matt, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What history of science is kind of, it's not a field that a lot of people get into right off the bat at the beginning of their academic career. What brought you to the field of the history of science? Did you start off in the sciences, or did you start off as a historian, or neither one of those things? Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. I think my story is not atypical. I was originally studying material science and engineering as an undergraduate and wound up getting my undergrad degree in that. And I would say maybe about in my sophomore, my junior year, I got a little bit bored and I just kept asking, when are we going to get to the big questions that help to contextualize the kind of work that I was doing? So I signed up one semester to fulfill my electives in two history of science courses. One of them was a science and religion course with Larry Principe, and the other was a hybrid graduate undergraduate course on the scientific revolution by Pam Long. And I thought I was going to drop one of these courses, and I wound up having to go to the undergraduate dean's office to say, hey, can I take more credits? Because it was just an eye-opening experience. I read Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and I thought, hey, this sounds like the experience that I'm encountering, especially what he had to say about textbooks. So from that moment, I was hooked, but there was a long period of time. So I wound up doing a double major, but there was a long period of time where I thought, well, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to feed myself if I go into history. So I should stick to this engineering thing.
And it's actually really interesting to hear because Pam and Larry in particular tend to be historians of science who are really concerned with practice, right? And with talking about artisanship. And so I can sort of, as you're saying that, I can kind of see the link between that to looking at another kind of sort of conceptual workers, but also practitioners, which is engineers. So the book that we're talking about today explores discourses and debates over technology in American life in the 60s, so roughly between 1964 and 1974. And this is a moment where, as you put it, engineers were at war with their ideals. And this exploration of the professionalism, the ethics, and the kind of career in wrestling with technological futures is something that we'll talk about in the course of the chapters of the book. This book also, for listeners, launches the engineering studies series for the MIT Press. So, Matt, how did you come to focus on engineers in particular as your interest, as your main interest in the history of science, at least for the purpose of this book?
Well, when I went to graduate school, I never would have thought that I would have come so close to writing about my own encounters. But like many projects, that's what happened. I was an engineering student, as I just mentioned, and I spent a little bit of time working at the Army Research Laboratory in Aberdeen Proving Ground. And I had this experience of working with quite excellent people and great mentors, but in this world that seemingly had been built after the Second World War and continuing on through the Cold War, and this tension between what are the goals of scientific and technological labor, what are the responsibilities that individuals have with respect to making weapons technologies, with working in local communities and that kind of thing. And I wouldn't have thought I would have written about this. But then when I was at Princeton, I was taking a history of U.S. cultural and intellectual history course with Dan Rogers, and he sort of saw my interest and he said, hey, you know, there was a person at Princeton, a professor in the 60s named Steve Slaby, who was in the engineering department, but he was also one of the leaders of organizing the student movement and various kinds of campus protests. And Mike Mahoney, who was my advisor, said, hey, you know, there's this guy named Steve Slaby who was in the 60s and, you know, maybe you should look into that. And I thought, okay, well, I'll see what they have in special collections, and I found his papers, and it opened up a much broader world that I didn't know existed. And I also found when I was in the engineering library at Princeton, all of these social theory books on the shelves that had clearly gotten a lot of use, but that seemed out of place in today's world to be there. So that was really the origin of the project, and it expanded outward from there.
Awesome. And we'll talk a little bit about Slaby when we get to chapter 5, because he's one of he forms the kind of crux of one of the case studies that we look at there. So, Matt, this started out as a dissertation at Princeton, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book manuscript and then to book? Were there any major transformations along the way? Were there any surprises or any notable aspects of that process for you that you'd like to talk about for us?
Well, I would say the biggest surprise is how long it took. Yeah. but I finished very quickly. I was lucky enough to get a postdoc position while I was in my fifth year. So the dissertation was finished in a haste and wound up done, I think, 2 or 3 days before I started teaching at Washington University in St. Louis. And so I wound up in the course of sending a proposal, responding to reviewers, revising, expanding the dissertation dramatically, and essentially rewriting everything a couple of times. There are, I think I did maybe 4 or 5 of the archival studies came after the dissertation. So there's quite a lot of new material. There's a new chapter. And I think what happens when you go through this process of dissertation to book is that you do an enormous amount of recalibrating your argument, coming at it with a much more sort of mature and robust approach, and that I can look back at the dissertation and see that the elements of it there, but it's hard to even express how different it seems to me to look at now from what I wrote back then.
And I think it's an amazing book. And so congratulations on that. And I think a lot of the people who I talk to really value and put a lot of emphasis on the importance of taking that time between dissertation and book manuscript to mature and to let the ideas and the work develop. And it really seems like it paid off here.
Well, thanks. And I guess I would say that if you can take that time, absolutely. I think it's becoming a little bit harder, but find a way.
Now, so let's get into the book itself. Now, one of the things I want to start off by asking you has to do with the structure of the book and the chapters. So each, and the first one in particular. So each, or certainly most of the chapters open up with a quotation, some sort of epigraph that sets the tone for the rest of the chapter, the rest of what's to come in those pages. Now, the epigraph for the introduction itself, as you know, the kind of first epigraph in a book tends to do, really sets the tone for the book as a whole. And here, it's a different kind of quotation from what we see in the other chapters. You choose to open the introduction with a quotation from Carlo Ginzburg's The Cheese and the Worms. And I think this is a quotation that's about Pinocchio. Can you talk a little bit to get us started into the project as a whole about that choice? Why did you choose to open with that particular section, and how does that motivate what's to come in the rest of the introduction and the book for us?
So my mind was lofty and wished for a new world and way of life. I mean, to me, that captured the essence of both the radical engineers I was looking at and those engineers in high positions of leadership in the National Academy of Engineering or in corporations or in university deans and the like. And people don't often think about engineers as intellectuals. And engineers don't get a lot of formal training as intellectuals, though many of them, especially those who become interested in reform, are deeply concerned with problems of the mind. And for me, so I encountered the Cheese and the Worms as an undergraduate, and it was one of those books that opened up the possibilities to me as an engineer of what the humanities brought to the table. It was such a strange take. So there's this local miller who is being put on trial by the Inquisition, and he's trying to explain his interpretation of a kind of natural philosophy, of politics, of religion, of all of this kind of stuff, at which he's encountering through books and is then trying to, I don't know, proselytize is not the right word, but he gets in trouble for sharing these words, his ideas, and trying to get other people to listen to him. And so for me, that was both a signal of the kind of method that I wanted to apply, the sort of cultural, intellectual, historical model. I'm really interested in how it is that engineers create meaning and how that meaning affects the way in which they define and solve problems. But it also, to me, really hinted at the aspirational approach that these people who I was exploring brought to their lives. I mean, this for many of these people was a transformative experience where they broke out of old ways of seeing.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Now, as we get into the body of the book itself, the book focuses on the period between 1964 and 1974 in the history of engineers and engineering in America. But there's a lot of attention in the book placed on the transition between this period and what came before, and so that the particular challenges that this period raised for not just American society and the revisiting of the place of technology and the understanding of technology within that society, but also the placement of and the situation of engineers within this larger context. So to understand or to get us to what's so special about this period of the 1960s, can you talk a little bit about the immediate period before? So what was it like to be an engineer in America in the immediate aftermath of World War II, say from 45 to 64. What did that period before the period that we're talking about involve, so that we can understand the change that happens?
Sure. Well, I think to really get at that change, you need to go back even further. So much of the literature about the history of engineering was written in this period of the 1960s and the early 1970s and informed by the kinds of stuff that I talk about in the book. But most of that literature is about engineering at the turn of the 20th century and engineering through the Depression, because this is a period where the engineer really rises to the fore as a kind of cultural hero. If you go back into the 1920s and the 1930s, you can find, books that sell millions of copies about the way in which engineers are kind of rugged American heroes who are organizing and ordering the frontier, who are bringing electricity to people who don't have it. And at the same time, engineering is in the United States is very much tied to the rise of corporate organization. Most engineers worked in fairly large companies. But we see, to get to World War II, we see during World War II just a dramatic expansion in the number of engineers trained, the kind of things that they're learning, the positions that they take place. So from 1945 to the mid-1960s, the engineering profession increases fourfold. So about 250,000 engineers in the early 1940s and over a million in the mid-1960s. Something on the order of, and I don't have it in front of me, so I apologize if the statistics are wrong, but something on the order of 75% of engineers work in 1% of all firms. Now, the aerospace industry is at the heart of this. The aerospace industry almost did not exist prior to the First World War. It was a craft industry that employed maybe 50,000 people. To by the 1960s, it's employing over 2 million people. The 10 biggest companies, aerospace companies, employ a huge number of the engineers out there. Another thing that I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with is the sort of the rise of the scientist and the physicist in particular as the kind of cultural icon of technical and scientific labor after the Second World War, as a consequence of the atomic bomb and radar and things like that. And so engineers have this sort of contest of professional identity with the sciences. At the same time, the amount of graduate training that engineers has is expanding dramatically. It used to be the case that you would get an undergraduate degree and go work directly. A master's degree increasingly becomes the norm. And there's definitely a sort of PhD envy going on as well.
Great. Thank you. And you talk in the book about the ways that the Cold War changed things for U.S. engineers. And so, along the lines of the kinds of things you're talking about, higher education becomes a dominant path of entry into the profession. There's a ton of engineers. I mean, this would seem to be a really positive period for engineers. This would seem to be, I think, a period that you may have referred to in the book as a golden age for engineers. However, in the decade that follows this period from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, technology takes on a kind of sinister and ambiguous connotation in American society, and it's this moment that we see engineers who we don't typically think of as sort of radical or as involved in sort of major ethical developments or movements actually taking control in a way, or attempting to take control of their place in this changing technological landscape. Now, and the book is going to follow that through. Now, a thread that runs throughout the book that opens up in this first chapter is the relationship between what you call the is of society and the ought of society from the perspective of engineers who are navigating this change and this change in the technological society of America. Can you talk about that, the relationship between the is and the ought of society for engineers in this context?
Sure. And I think this goes back to your question about sort of going from dissertation to book a little bit. I mean, one of the intellectual or the kind of conceptual questions that I struggled with from the earliest moment of trying to work on this project up until I sort of, I think I figured it out, is am I talking with ideology? Am I talking with social imaginaries? What is the best way to describe how people who don't necessarily consider themselves to be political ideologues shape visions of the future that impact their everyday lives and the kind of work that they do? And I make the argument that engineering is normative by nature. It's always about some kind of future state, and that's always based on some kind of interpretation, some kind of contextualization of the present moment that is. I'm not the only person who talks in this way. I mean, I think Ken Alder wrote quite nicely about this in Engineering the Revolution, a book about the French engineers in the French Revolution. But I came to understand this stuff through the term of normative vision, which struck me as a way of not getting into all those old questions about what is ideology, is ideology constraining, and one that would allow talking about actors from a wide range of sort of formality in how they see the world. If we're looking at the people, the engineers who are writing their own magazines or who are creating national directives, these people clearly have a very formalized sense of how they contextualize the past, how it is that we got into the problems that we have, and what they want to have happen. But many of these engineers sort of on the margins don't necessarily have this. So I teach a course at Virginia Tech called Engineering Cultures. And one of the core themes about this is trying to show the different ways in which engineering is always concerned with this sort of temporal dimension, which is always tied to different societal goals. So I think I guess that's what I was trying to get at with the is and the ought of engineering thought.
Great, thank you. And this actually brings up another thing, or it lets me transition to another thing that seems really important to the book. In many ways, keywords and transformations in language are really crucial for the kind of analysis that you're presenting here in the book. So among many other things, and we'll come up, or we'll sort of come to several of them in the course of our conversation, the story that you're telling traces the ways that technology becomes a keyword and one with changing meanings in the 20th century and certainly in the 60s. Related to this, one of the crucial concepts that you raise in the book and the crucial sets of terms really speaks to the ideological issue that you were just talking about. And this is the idea of an ideology of technological change, which pushes, again, it sort of looks into the future and situates the engineer in time, and I think precisely the way you were just talking about. Do you want to talk just a little bit more about this particular notion, the ideology of technological change, in its importance to the way engineers are struggling with their own place in the as a profession and in the context of the Technological Society of America in the mid-60s and up to the mid-70s?
Sure. Well, I think I want to do two things. I'll say a little bit about the notion of keywords and how I use those, how that fits in with broader sort of shifts in the history of technology as a field. And then I'll get to the ideology of technological change, because that's really the core argument of the book. And I think is the most important consequence of the book, the naming of this thing.
Awesome.
So in terms of the, you know, there's a long tradition of keyword analysis. Not surprisingly, Dan Rogers, who I worked with, has a book that talks about keywords in American political thought. There's a tradition that goes back to people like Raymond Williams. But while I was working on this as a dissertation, I was aware that I was a part of an emerging trend in the intellectual history of technology or cultural intellectual history of technology, which, you know, on the surface doesn't seem all that surprising, but this was the history of technology is a field that often is most concerned with things, with artifacts, with systems, with networks. And people like Eric Schatzberg, who went and looked at the origins of the idea of technology and discovered that, and Leo Marx as well, discovered that really until the 1920s and the 1930s, this word did not have the meaning that it has now, and it did not have the kind of powerful presence in global discourse that it currently has. So I was kind of working in this area, and one of the moments when I felt like I really had stumbled onto something is, I don't know if you remember the computer lab at the bottom of the history building, but I was down there doing an analysis of in the New York Times database, trying to trace out the rise of this word technology over time. So I would go in and I would plug in, okay, the year 1935, and how many times does technology happen? How many times does the engineer happen? And I saw these graphs, these two words converging and then going off in the opposite direction. And so in the book, this chart is at the front of the introduction, because to me, that was an indication that they meet in 1968. So this is kind of a semantic reversal happening at the very moment that the United States is in turmoil, the engineering profession is in turmoil, technology is being accused as responsible for all of these things. And I showed this to people, and they're like, oh, that's nice. That's okay. But now with things like Google Ngram, this has become really the norm for a gut check analyses of the, you know, cultural resonance of particular kinds of words. And now I could do that same chart, which really took me at least a day. And then I played around with it and I kept doing these funny things. You could do in less than 10 seconds or something like that. So the keyword thing, I was sort of a real challenge for people who look at and analyze things in these terms is, you know, sort of how robust is that? How that doesn't really make sense outside of the context of a thick description kind of analysis. So from all of that kind of work, I also am drawing on an important book by Langdon Winner, Autonomous Technology, which looks at many of these theorists of technology in the 1960s. And he briefly uses the term ideology of technological change. The term kind of appears also in Rosalind Williams' book, Retooling. But for me, what was fascinating was the ways in which engineers were deeply responsible for creating this idea. So what is the ideology of technological change? Basically, it's an argument that, okay, technology is not inherently progressive. We don't believe that anymore. But technology is a semi-autonomous force that, in a sense, has its own nature. Now, the way in which engineers can engage with this is to become socio-technologists, people who are aware of both societal effects of technology and the ability to produce technology itself. So the argument of this, and it goes back all the way to William Ogburn in the 1920s and the 1930s, but it becomes a kind of dominant way of thinking at this period in the 1960s that I talk about. And the argument is that technology is accelerating at a faster pace than social institutions can handle. And what we need is somebody to help figure out the positive impacts of technology, to maximize those, understand that there are unintended, and unintended is a crucial key word here, unintended negative effects that are inevitable. People are always going to be displaced. Economic disruption is always going to happen with new technologies. And, you know, there's a kind of economic tradition. We could look at people like Joseph Schumpeter and others. So the engineer's role here, at least the socio-technologist's role, the expert who understands technology and society together, is to help society adjust by maximizing the positives and minimizing the negatives. This does a lot of things. It lets engineers off the hook for all of the problems that do exist. They can say, well, look, this is a new way of understanding the world. These problems are emergent. These problems are new. We want to solve them just as much as anybody else. And in fact, if you look to the elite, we're the people best prepared to help you solve them. But it also kind of settles this challenge within the engineering profession between radicals and the establishment by sort of taking away the political anxiety about all of this stuff by saying that, look, it's okay. This we know what's going on here. We know we need to change, and we know we need to change in these particular ways.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Now, as we move through the book, you show us early on here how the engineer was once a hero. And this hero became, in the 1960s, the, quote, dark-suited, short-sleeved, nondescript white man with black-rimmed glasses, or rather goes from a virile pioneer to someone who watches paint dry. Now, after a chapter that looks at the origins of American engineers' progressive ideals in a context where technological prosperity is really redefining what it means to be an engineer, right? There's the rise of environmental civil rights and anti-war movements. U.S. society becomes characterized by these technologies that are suddenly sort of making these ideological issues really trenchant in a new way. Nuclear weapons, chemical pollutants, digital computers. And you have a chapter that looks at the way engineers become actors in debates about technology and the common good in this context. And the rest of the chapters then are going to look at specific ways that this happened and specific kinds of contexts and places where we see engineers agitating for change amongst themselves and amongst their own profession, as well as in society at large. Chapter 3 looks at the importance of the theme of technological change in a new genre of technology and society writing that cuts across academic disciplines. And this is perhaps really interesting for those who are, for readers who might be particularly interested in STS, history of technology as disciplines. This is really an interesting moment in the emergence of these disciplines here. You've talked already about one of the major early figures of this chapter, political philosopher Langdon Winner. Another really interesting case study here focuses on the Harvard University program in technology and society, which became, as you show, a kind of lightning rod in this battle between ideologues of technological politics and technological change. So can you talk a little bit about this Harvard University program on technology and society? What's going on there, and why is that important for the general argument that you're making in this part of the book?
Sure. Well, I mean, the Harvard Program on Technology and Society, which I find that I talk to more senior scholars in the field who were sort of just getting started in their careers at this point, and they all remember this thing. It was incredibly prolific. It started in 1964 and was initially intended to go for 10 years, but it got cut off a little bit early. It was founded by IBM. This was a social science sort of policy think tank at Harvard that had a $5 million budget. Now, for the social sciences in 1964, that was a lot of money. And the guy they put in charge was somebody who was more or less an unknown. This guy, Mestany, had been worked at the Rand Corporation. He had directed the orchestra there. He had served as a translator during the Second World War. He had a degree in philosophy. And he was kind of a jack of all trades of the social sciences and the kind of policy world. And the idea was that this program was designed to understand technology in its entirety, to look at the positive and the negative benefits of technology. And there's still some speculation about why IBM was interested in this, though I ran into somebody who worked in IBM, who worked in the Harvard Computing Center. And there is some speculation that this was tied to Harvard picking IBM as its core provider of, or its core supplier of computers. But this project really brought together what we now kind of talk about as defense intellectuals. So its advisory board included presidents of oil companies, presidents of automobile companies. It included a Supreme Court justice. It included congressmen. It included university presidents. So this was sort of like a who's who of the elite of this military, industrial, academic complex. And it funded a huge number of projects. They sent their annual reports out to every library, every kind of congressional office, any kind of institution that would have some connection to technology. And what I think the initial plan was to provide a kind of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary overview of how technology and society were interacting and how to go about confronting these challenges that really everybody saw and everybody recognized as important. I mean, the concept of technology itself loomed so large at this moment. What it became was sort of a strong proponent of this point of view I call an ideology of technological change. But rather than putting engineers in charge, it was Mestini's argument and the argument of some of the people who worked here that really you needed new kinds of social scientists who could stand outside of these existing debates and intervene in them. And just to kind of give you another sense of its prominence, you know, it had feature articles in Science, it had a front page story in the New York Times. These guys really were the people you wanted to learn about technology from in the period.
Great. And alongside this emergence of what you're characterizing here as a new genre of technology and society writing, there's also, we see in this chapter and in this period, the emergence of this new society for technology and society. And I'm talking about the Society for the History of Technology, or the organization some listeners may be more familiar with as SHOT. Can you just speak a little bit to the emergence of SHOT in this context?
Sure. Well, I mean, I hope I don't get into too much trouble with SHOT, because I think SHOT is really interesting. I mean, it's one of the societies that, you know, one of my favorite meetings to go to, and one of the societies that I always felt most at home about my own work. But you can see the ways in which these tensions between sort of more critical, radical ways of thinking about technology and this ideology of technological change approach sort of operated. And many of the founding fathers of SHOT were of this ideology of technological change perspective. They were also a prominent voice for Mestini. They had their fourth annual review was their big major report, and they got a slew of people to comment on that report and to kind of give it some sort of stamp of certification. I would, I guess, direct the reader to learn more about SHOT after this.
Okay, great. Now, one of the things that emerges in this part of the book that continues to be a really important theme is the variety among this community that we're loosely calling engineers. I mean, there were actually significant disagreements among engineers as to how to deal with these changes in the profession and how to deal with or how to constitute themselves as a profession in the face of technological change in American society. Now, as we move into the next chapter, you look at the crisis among engineers in the 60s over one aspect of that professionalism, namely what it meant to be a responsible professional and what an ethics of responsibility meant. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because this here in this part of the book emerges as another of these key words that really or around which, on which the argument in this history really pivots. Can you talk about the rhetoric of responsibility? What did that mean for engineers here? And why was that so important as a key word in this period?
Sure. Well, I think I'll reveal a little more craft stuff because maybe readers want that kind of thing, and then relate that to the other chapter so you kind of get a big overview and then dip into the responsibility thing. So you mentioned, well, how do you talk about engineers loosely defined and how do you incorporate this broad variety of opinion? I mean, when you're talking about a profession that includes over a million people, sort of how do you write about a million people? You don't. or you write about it in a way in which you try to capture flashpoints around which this diversity of opinion, we can kind of draw it out. And for people sort of versed in the literature, you'll might notice that each chapter kind of centers itself also around a really big key work in the history of science or in STS or in the history of technology, and tries to reinterpret an existing question set through this lens of engineers dealing with this crisis. So responsibility is probably the most significant key word in the history of technology and the history of engineering in the literature that's out there. Most critically, there's a book called Revolt of the Engineers by Edwin Layton that comes out in the early 1970s. It gets reviewed by some of these engineers that I'm talking about. And he looks at the ways in which responsibility played its way, well, how there were questions about social responsibility emerged in the progressive era and how engineers used this for different things. And his argument is that responsibility gets deeply tied to the notion of what it means to be an engineering professional, but that responsibility gets tied to your employer, your professional colleagues, and and lastly, and sometimes not really even mentioned, sort of to society at large. All of this stuff is under discussion and really it starts to erode in the late 1960s when you get new ideas about responsibility. Concepts of social responsibility coming from the sort of a new left, other kinds of notions of responsibility coming out of reactions to physicists' participation in nuclear weapons design. You get the emergence of sort of oppositional science groups and other kinds of things like that. And responsibility is one of these words that loses all meaning. I mean, who doesn't want to be responsible? Who does not want to be seen as doing the righteous thing? Who doesn't want to be seen as being progressive? So every actor in here has an interpretation of responsibility. And so to sort of see how they get played out is says something to me about the challenges of language in social movements. But it also, I think, says something about the limitations of the deep historical connection in engineering between the notion of the engineer as an autonomous professional and the ways in which being able to act responsibly comes out of a kind of ideal that very rarely meets reality.
Now, in this chapter, you talk specifically about the American Society of Mechanical Engineers as an example of processes of reform in societies of engineers. Can you talk a little bit about the AsME in this context? Why is it such a good example here? And how would you characterize the kind of debates that members in the society are having around these problems?
Sure. Well, I mean, first off, it's a great case because one of the key figures of many figures in the book is a man named Victor Paschkes, who is just a remarkable person. Here's a guy who was born at the late 19th century, lived in Austria, then worked in Germany, and then came to the United States fleeing the Nazis, and made a career for himself as sort of a researcher at Columbia. And was a pacifist, was involved, was a conscientious objector during World War II, was involved in the Society for Social Responsibility and Science. And once these debates start taking place, he's already in his 60s. But here's a guy who's also looking to this new technology and society literature and trying to recalibrate and remake his understanding of what responsibility is, a question that he's been asking for decades. And he starts to emerge as a voice in debates within this society. At the same time, the American Society for Mechanical Engineers puts out something called the AsME goals around 1970, which are an attempt as a society-wide, the AsME, I think at the time, and again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but maybe it's about 60,000 members. It creates these goals that's going to make technology a true servant of man. That's the tagline. You can kind of see that understanding of responsibility in that. And there's the president who is behind this is also deeply committed to educational reform, to the reform of engineering toward kind of more humanitarian ends. He's a dean at Catholic University of America. Donald Marlowe is his name. And these guys have relatively similar visions, but they're operating in different parts. So we get the grassroots and we get the kind of from the top down. And for me, it was interesting to see how these people interacted. It wasn't that they were directly oppositional, but they were trying to navigate all of these contentions that were going on around them.
Great. Now, from this set of issues surrounding responsibility and the issue of, or the problem of responsibility in this context, we move to a context in which the question emerges, how far were engineers willing to take beliefs that involved alternatives to responsible professionalism? So what happens when you're an engineer? How far were some engineers willing to go to actually oppose or to sort of step away from these ethics of responsible professionalism in order to manage circumstances that seem to call for opposition to dominant professional norms in some cases. Now, this chapter, I'm talking about Chapter 5 in particular, looks at a series of episodes that really span the spectrum of responses in this vein, from what you call centrist conversion to a really revolutionary rhetoric. And you look at three case studies here. One is a small research lab at MIT that becomes a kind of model for conversion because the engineers there are able to kind of recast what they're doing without faulting publicly the military or government, so keeping that kind of support. But another case study here speaks to one of the examples that you brought up at the very beginning of our conversation when you talked about Slaby and Princeton. So can you talk a little bit about what's happening here at Princeton University with Slaby, and how does this case study really open up some of the concerns of this part of the book for you?
Sure. I guess the first thing I would say is also this is a good case of graduate students starting to write as early as they can and starting to share as early as they can, because this the root of this comes from the first thing I ever published in History of Science in 2003. That sort of started to get this kernel of this idea of the boundaries of the system and the kinds of opposition and what that opposition meant. But Slaby in particular, I think, is an interesting case. Here is an individual guy who has a very different background than his peers. So he came out of industrial Detroit. He didn't have a PhD. He was a socialist throughout his life. He was a Fulbright in Norway and talked about labor politics and wrote about labor politics there. He was also a professor of engineering graphics. And engineering graphics and, you know, think mechanical drawing, this is the kind of thing that, especially at a place like Princeton, which embraced the notion of engineering science, that aerospace and, you know, nuclear engineering and things like that, that was where the future of being an engineer was. So there are a couple things going on. I mean, first, there's the political dimension where Slaby is always, I wouldn't say radicalized, but he was always politically aware and always willing to speak up, which is not typical. But at the same time, the kind of work he's doing is being devalued substantially, to the point where the courses that he's been teaching that had been standard courses required of all incoming students get replaced by introduction to computers and other kinds of newer skill sets for these new sort of scientific engineers. So for me, it was really interesting to see, here's a guy who is motivated through ideals, but is also motivated through his economic situation. At the same time, he's a tenured professor, so he has the ability to do this, and he has the ability to retool. So he starts to become a politics instructor, and he starts to teach sort of proto science, technology, and society courses. And I think you can see that model in other universities as well. And so he winds up kind of isolated, but inside this existing system, and finds a new identity through being a kind of interpreter of science and technology and society.
And this is all happening in the context of agitation around the Vietnam War. And he's actually, in the process of this, he mounts a campaign against defense research at Princeton. Is that right?
Yeah. And so I think where he's most successful is around the question of secret sort of sponsored research. Princeton establishes an off-campus research center where the aerospace engineers are. After the sort of faltering of the military-industrial complex, those engineers can make their way back onto the main campus. And Slaby is not the only person behind this, but he does create a huge tension from within the departments and within the School of Engineering itself.
Now, another example that comes up in this chapter that I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about, because this is an example that actually you begin the entire book with earlier on in the introduction, is the alternative press for the Committee for Social Responsibility in Engineering. And they produce a journal called Spark. Can you speak a little bit about that example and that case and the kind of work it's doing for you here?
Sure. And this goes back to the sort of work done after the dissertation. I did not have access to this Spark magazine until I was on my postdoc and was doing some other archival stuff. And when the archives were closed, looking in the library stacks at UCLA, and was able to get my hands on this. And if anybody is out there and really wants to get at what this book is about, see if you can find some copies of Spark magazine. I mean, they're remarkable. So the image I have in the book of a cover of this shows the kind of classic clenched power fist shooting a lightning bolt into a transistor to make a peace sign. And it includes articles such as, tax resistance, and Pentagon Capital, Seymour Melman's Pentagon Capitalism. Another one has doing it at the workplace, revolutionary engineering. And these guys were the Committee for Social Responsibility in Engineering came out of conversations with engineers at Columbia, Brooklyn Polytechnic, and RCA, and other sort of places in the metro New York area. And the participants as a whole were not what we necessarily sort of virulent radicals, but they were very open to all of the kinds of flows of information that were taking place at the time. And so their first issue is essentially just a compilation of 50 different things from underground presses elsewhere, from more establishment sort of centrist groups looking to influence science and technology policy. And this group to me was a kind of perfect window into the uncertainty of being a radical engineer. Could you still be radical and be an engineer?
Right.
And I think for many of the participants, the ultimate answer was no. They came out on the other side as very motivated internal critics who are also strong supporters of what it meant to be an engineer. And I think many of the ones who were talked about dropping out. I opened the chapter, that section, with one of the articles where the author says, "I am a dropout from the military-industrial complex," and then goes to talk about his experience of conversion and his awakening. And it winds up, he's trying to find a new mode of living and a new mode of life. So many of the people who sort of went that route, I think, fall out of the engineering profession traditionally defined.
Now, as we move further into the last chapters of the book, we move from debates about responsibility and sort of debates about how to engage in a kind of radical way among engineers, and we look at efforts by engineers to remake themselves and remake society under the banner of what you call humane technology. So in this part of the book, going back to keywords, we see the importance of a discourse of creativity, a discourse of collaboration, and also an emphasis on process over structure, process-oriented design. Now, this chapter is called Three Bridges to Creative Renewal, and along those lines, you look in detail at three efforts to create bridge-building networks by engineers. One of these bridges is between expert and user, so you look at contributions to the appropriate technology movement by a group called Volunteers for International Technical Assistance, or VITA. You also look at bridges between research labs and artistic studios, and the case study for that is a group called Experiments in Art and Technology, or EAT. And thirdly, the third kind of bridge, is a bridge between developmental agencies and corporate boardrooms. And here you look at a group called the Innovation Group. Can you choose one of these three bridge building networks, perhaps whichever one you find most inspiring or more interesting, and talk a little bit about what's going on there in the context of the broader argument of this part of the book?
Sure. I guess first, why three? I mean, this chapter was the hardest to write. In the dissertation, it was just about experiments in art and technology. But then I discovered VITA and this in the innovation group, which I encountered very early on. And so I think I'll talk a little bit more about the innovation group. But what held these together was a certain kind of commonality of organizing people from very disparate activities toward very disparate ends, making art, making development policy, making innovators. And at the same time, they were all sort of using the same kind of currents of collaboration, creativity, the emphasis on process. And when I finally put them all together, it was this sort of moment where the pieces clicked, where it started to sort of come out and make sense that the best way to understand this humane technology is not necessarily through looking at the iconoclast, but looking at how these different groups of reformers engaged with iconoclasts around this notion of humane technology. I mean, the innovation group to me is the most interesting because it sort of points me where I'm headed next. The innovation group included some of these people from the Harvard program on technology and society. It included people like Donald Schoen, who was another kind of jack of all trades doing technical consulting, philosophy, educational research. It included these kind of, I don't know, hip corporate technologists who were right there to a large extent with the counterculture, but who saw that the real changes they believed were to be made from within inside the corporation itself. So it wasn't that you would drop out. It's that you would look and see the kind of flexibility, the openness, all of those kinds of things that Fred Turner talks about when he looks at Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth catalog, but that are happening kind of simultaneously inside the system. And they put together one of the most amazing magazines I've ever seen, a magazine called Innovation, which is sort of high gloss, pop aesthetic. It did not have any advertising. And when it first started, to be a member of the Innovation Group was $75. At the time, I think Fortune magazine cost something like $15 a year, which was seen as, oh, maybe it was five times more than any other magazine. So this thing was sort of off the charts in terms of its elite status. But in their first few issues, they would simultaneously have reports on the research strike at MIT about resistance to doing defense work. They had an essay by Paul Goodman, which was the precursor to his famous Can Technology Be Humane that appeared in the New York Review of Books. But they would also have this stuff about, you know, like how to create a corporate response to critics of your company and how to reconvert a defense lab into an environmental lab using government funding and things like that. So it was this really interesting mix of hip change managers trying to figure out the pathway of a new identity that didn't fit into being an engineer or being an executive or being a business person. And this notion of innovation, which they're sort of like the proto founders of this concept, which has a longer history, but this language of innovation from really the late 1960s up until the 1980s emerges as an alternative way of doing techno-scientific labor. So I think I'll stop with that and see what else you have to ask me.
No, that's great. And it's actually, that's a really, really fascinating part of the chapter. So I'm glad to have heard a little bit more about it. So as we come to the last chapters of the book, you have a chapter, chapter 7, that explores really the way that educational reform was crafted by engineers with engineers in this context. And this chapter looks at four different institutions of formal training that all either built from scratch or revised their curricula to account for the changing meanings of technology and engineering in society, and also the changing ways of thinking about what made an ideally educated engineer. So the four cases that you look at, I'm not going to ask you to talk about all of them, but you just for listeners, you look at UCLA, a comprehensive state university, you look at Caltech, an elite private research institute, Harvey Mudd College, and MIT. So is there Can you maybe choose one of those four examples, and again, one that you find most important, most interesting, perhaps most surprising, and talk about that in the context of this focus on education and educational reform in this last part of the book?
Sure. I guess I would say first that education was really where the rubber hit the road. So this is why this chapter is the last sort of body chapter of the book. You can see in these institutions all of the early themes that I talked about, things like responsibility, the desire to foster creativity and collaboration, the desire to somehow negotiate this radicalism and to incorporate it into making more open-minded future engineers. And I think that, I mean, it's hard to pick a favorite, but I think that MIT is last in there because MIT is also the best case for showing how all of these other threads that you can see in the other cases kind of exist at the same time. I mean, to be at MIT in the 1960s and the early 1970s was just a time of tremendous upheaval. They have this research strike. They have all kinds of new intellectual directions taking shape. There are tons. I mean, basically every unit is involved in some interdisciplinary project with some other unit around this, with the notion of interdisciplinarity sort of being a conceptual hinge that's doing a lot of work. And out of this, you get a lot of different kinds of projects. You get there's a group called the Technology and Culture Seminar that includes faculty from mostly every department, many engineers, but also many humanists who get together and debate Alou, who wrote The Technological Society, and Lewis Mumford and Herbert Marcuse. And they get into these heated and really earnest conversations about what to make of all of this kind of stuff. You get MIT hires as a lecturer the former president of Students for a Democratic Society. You have many conservative engineers and students and faculty who are kind of pushing back against this kind of stuff. But what's really fascinating here is you also get this idea of, well, what we really need is something like an integrated humanist, social scientist, engineer, a technologist. And we see the same thing happening in some of these other places, but MIT is one of the few places that tried to make this into a formal kind of professional activity. And you see the emergence of the field of science and technology and society, or science and technology studies, at MIT, which takes a little bit longer. I mean, it's really not until the late 1970s that this takes place, but it builds on efforts by things like Technology Studies Initiative by engineers like Larry Bucciarelli, who are working with MIT's emergent kind of historian social scientist community. So we see the kind of professionalization of STS, and I don't know if breaking is the wrong word, but the reducing of that connection between what professional scholars of science and technology and society do and what technical practitioners, engineers, and scientists do. The ideal in almost all of these cases were that these people were to be engaged in the same project of making the material world.
Great. Well, Matt, thank you so much. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So rather than asking you about it, I'll just mention for listeners that there's also an epilogue in the book that takes this story and pushes it forward, looking at, for example, the way that this sort of environment of engineering professionalism and sort of engineers looking at their own place within American technological society transforms in the 1980s. And it also looks in particular at two really interesting groups, the Engineering Social Justice and Peace Network and Engineers Without Borders. So I'll just mention that for listeners to look particularly at that, because there's a lot more in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. So along those lines, Matt, there's of course a ton in the book that we didn't have a chance to get to. It's a very rich study. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say related to the epilogue is that I don't see this book as about something dead that happened a long time ago. I mean, I see all of these questions reemerging today, and I see that the significance of them for practitioners in the engineering world, and in particular, more likely for listeners of this, for those of us who are teaching scientists and engineers, that these questions about the is and the ought of technology and who the professional identity of the technologist ought to be are really critical.
Wonderful. And now that this book is out, and congratulations, it's a great book. What's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you at the moment?
I thought the goal was to write a book and then never do anything else.
Right, that's what they tell us, right?
No, so I'm already sort of working on the second book, which again comes out of this innovation group. The working title is Inventing Innovators, Innovation Expertise, and the Making of a Late 20th Century Techno-Scientific Selves. And it sets out to look at the rise of the sort of identity of the innovator as somebody who stands between all of these other existing professions and who is sort of navigating what it means to do science and technology in a post-Vietnam era. So it looks mostly sort of from the 1960s through to the 1980s and is organized around following out these so-called innovation experts and showing how you can go from this tiny elite group called the Innovation Group to now, and the National Science Foundation, for example, has something called the Innovation Corps or the I-Corps. So, you know, everything has to have an I in front of it, which is intended to turn academic scientists into hybrids who can negotiate the world of entrepreneurship, who can work on creative and collaborative solutions through to policy questions through science and technology. So that's the big future direction.
Well, that sounds awesome too. And so best of luck with that project, Matt, and we'll check back in once that's out too. And I'd love to talk to you about that once that's done. But in the meantime, congratulations on the book. And thank you so much for making time to talk with me today.
Thank you. This was really quite a blast.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.